Okay, good evening all. We are looking this week, it's the second in the series of the Chief Rabbis of Israel, and we're going more or less in chronological order. Last week we looked at Rav Kook, who was the Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of pre-state Israel. And this week we're looking at Rav Herzog, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Herzog, who was the first Chief Rabbi of Medinat Yisrael. He took over from Rav Kook. He became Chief Rabbi in, I think, 1936. So he was Chief Rabbi during the Shoah years, the immediate aftermath of the Shoah, and also during the first decade or so of Medinat Yisrael. So he was played a very key role in Jewish life at that time. Rav Herzog had an English connection, as did quite a number of the, or at least three of the chief rabbis of Medinat or Eretz Yisrael. Rav Herzog, he was born in Lomza, but he came to England as a child, grew up in Leeds, and then was subsequently, he got a university degree, a PhD from the University of London, studied at the Sorbonne in France, became chief rabbi of Ireland, and then subsequently became the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. Was very highly regarded, despite his PhD, which sort of doesn't quite fit in with the Eastern European model, but was very highly regarded as an outstanding Talmid Chacham by authorities across the world and across the Orthodox spectrum. You see in his Shelot and Shuvot correspondences with, the greats of the day, with the likes of the Chazon Ish, Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, and others. He was the first one really to assume the role of what I would call a modern chief rabbi. We sort of touched on this last time round, in the sense that, you know, when we looked at Rav Kook, it's true he was the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, and he was, you know, playing his role at a very important time in the development of Jewish history. But essentially, Rav Kook was a Rav. So he was paskening on some, you know, fairly big issues. But you look through his Shelot and Tshuvot, take out the Shemitah issue and move that to one side. In terms of everything else, you know, it was standard Rabbonish Ashailas that you would expect the Rav of a city to be dealing with. Mikvaot and Gittin and Eruvin and Kashrut and all those sorts of things. There was nothing that really suggested that this was the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, which in our minds at least suggests an association with wider Jewry as well at a critical time in Jewish history. Rav Herzog, I think, had a somewhat different model of a chief rabbinate whether it was by design or that's just the way the situation manifests itself, I'm not entirely sure. But again, you know, if we compare Rav Herzog with any of the poskim that we learned about last term, we'll see a significant shift in terms of Rav Herzog, by and large, was, you know, the first one to is the first one to have an official position where, you know, questions were posed to him in his official position. In terms of the others, were Gedole Hador, and you know, you don't apply for a job as Gadol Hador. You become a Gadol Hador. It's not a, you know, Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. He wasn't the official Rav of Vilna. So he didn't have a communal, you know, responsibility. He had the weight of the community on his shoulders, but he didn't necessarily have a communal responsibility. Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, during the last three decades of his life, you know, the preeminent posek in America, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of a fairly small yeshiva on the Upper East, Lower East Side. Not more than that. I mean, Shelot and Tshuvot, you know, Shelot came to him from all over the world, but he wasn't officially formulating public policy, which is kind of what we expect nowadays from a chief rabbi. Rav Kook, to a very limited extent, was formulating public policy. Rav Herzog, much more. We're going to look thoroughly only at three tshuvot this evening, but I just sort of made a list of some of the issues that that he tackles, and deals with. Some of the questions are just, the good old questions that come up time and time again, for a Rav in authority. He's got a fair amount, a lot on Gittin. Well, of course, he's the chief rabbi, so he was responsible for the Bat Edin throughout the country, and making sure that Gittin were properly administered. Questions on mikvaot, etc. Those aren't issues that particularly affect public policy, except perhaps, of course, where you're dealing with a less observant public. You've got issues. He addresses the question of changing Hebrew pronunciation from the Ashkenazi pronunciation to the modern pronunciation. We touched on this a little bit when we looked at Dan Weiss, the Mincha Yitzchak, probably 6-8 weeks ago. Discusses the old chestnut of whether or not you can include a person who doesn't keep Shabbat as part of a minyan. And that's like, kind of really interesting, because we saw that being addressed over the course of about, from the time of Rabbi Akiva Eiger onwards, the status of Mechallel Shabbat. That's a thread which has gone through all of these shiurim. They're nothing specifically to do with Eretz Yisrael or Medinat Yisrael. You've got a few things to do with changing technological advances. So, for example, you've got the question of whether or not you can use chemical analysis to identify either chametz in food or the kashrut of food. If you do a chemical analysis of a food, he has a tshuva about margarine, not sure what its origins are. So if you can prove through chemical analysis that it's kosher, is that acceptable? It's a similar question with regard to chametz. That's nothing particularly to do with Eretz Yisrael or Medinat Yisrael, but it's just sort of bayot hazman, sort of contemporary halakhic issues. Got the question, old question of civil marriage, a question with regard to Gittin, if the husband has to authorize the giving of a get, and that will be done by the husband in the Beit Din, or in another Beit Din where he will authorize it, and then one Beit Din will appoint a shaliach to communicate that to the next Beit Din. Ask the question, what if the husband sends a telegram to the Beit Din to say that he's giving a get? Is that acceptable? And of course, nowadays, can you divorce your wife, Khalilah, by email, as it were? I mean, you can't divorce her by email, but authorize the Beit Din by email would be an extension of that. It addresses the question, that Rav Kook looked at last week. Was the question of Mitzitza affair with the Brit Milah, whether or not the Moel has to suck the blood out of the wound with his mouth or not, and such things. So those are sort of typical shilas in Rabbonus. I made a list also of things which were specific to his position, I would say, as chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. Got a question about fixing the stones on the Kotel Hamaravi. Now this must have been pre 1948, because of course there wasn't Jewish access post 48. Okay, what it involved was the workman climbing up on the Kotel HaMaravi. You've got the question, has this got the kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash, in which case they can't clamber over it, or not? You've got questions about Israeli factories. The tshuva that I looked at was an Israeli factory in just outside Bnei Brak, Kivat Shmuel, I think, around there, which was making some sort of calcium something or other, where the machines needed to be running constantly, 7 days a week. It wasn't a process that you could just do in 2 days and shut down the, you know, do two or three runs a week and shut down the factory on a Friday afternoon. These questions came up somewhat in Chutz La'aretz, but in a Jewish state, they're much more pertinent and much more frequent. That was a question he was addressing, I think, in 1952. That's, you know, how are you going to keep Jewish businesses, you know, where it needs to carry on ticking over, even if nobody's involved in doing any malacha, is that going to be permitted or not permitted? Very interesting question was addressed to him by a soldier who had chofesh from the army for first day Rosh Hashanah, but had to be back at his army base on second day Rosh Hashanah. Interesting question. That's, was he better off driving or getting a lift with a non-Jewish driver or walking? That's, and the questions of Tchumin and, you know, walking too far outside the city, etc., etc. Well, yeah, that's keeping Shabbat, you know, protocols for Shabbat observance in the police. Shabbat observance at B'matzav Milchamat, times of war. Question of what are the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael in terms of keeping 2 days Yom Tov. I'm not talking about for tourists in Eretz Yisrael, I'm talking about for Israelis. The whole Eilat question. You know, do Israelis living in Eilat need to keep 2 days? Kavachom tourists. The question of Zeichel HaHakel. That's every seventh year in biblical times, there was a mitzvah that everybody would congregate the year after Sukkot, after Shemitah, and they would have the Hakel ceremony in Yerushalayim, where the king would read from the Sefer Torah. That was that ceremony was recreated in the early years of Medina Yerushalayim, and still takes place every time. That's, I went to it twice when I was in yeshiva. The first year I was in yeshiva, and the last year I was in yeshiva was the year after a shmita. So I went twice to that. But he's got the whole protocols there of how the Hakel ceremony should be observed in the absence of a Beit HaMikdash, etc., etc. A lot to do with Agunot, questions to do with Agunot from the Shoah, questions to do with Agunot from the War of Independence, the Agunot of the Gush Etzion fighters, Agunot in cases of you know, where military aircraft have gone missing and such things like that. All, you know, these are the questions falling on the shoulders of a chief rabbi. He addresses the question, this was a very classic question in its time, the question of the Bnei Israel from India and whether or not they had status of being Jews or not Jews. Very, you know, enormous question falling on his shoulders. The kashrut of the zebu. The zebu is some sort of cow-like animal, which is nishta cow. That's but they import a zebu meat into Israel. You haven't got enough cows in Israel to, you know, feed the population. Is zebu kosher or not? You might be a Rav Moshe Feinstein and get asked that shaila, but you don't have the communal responsibility to need to provide an answer. That's, as a gadol ador, you might feel you know, that you have to answer all the questions that you're asked. But, you know, Rav Herzog, as the Rav HaRashi, had to find an answer to these questions. He's got a number of tshuvot on the question of the model of the menorah outside the Knesset. The Gemara Masechet Rosh Hashanah says that you're not allowed to make replicas of the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash for your own use. So to have a seven-branched candelabra outside the Knesset, it addresses that question, is that permitted or not? A lot of questions to do with Geirut. Not necessarily to do with Geirut in Eretz Yisrael. These were questions addressed to communities outside of Eretz Israel in terms of establishing protocols for conversion. Interesting question about whether or not Herzl's remains should be exhumed and brought to Israel, which they were. And he's also got a tshuva which was written in the weeks before President Chaim Weizmann died. And as chief rabbi, he was trying to set out what should happen, how the state, how a Jewish state should react to the death of its president. That's really a fascinating range of questions that that he was asked and that he answered. I want to look at three specific issues which I think sort of give us an insight into the burdens of office that fell on his shoulders as chief rabbi. That's something you might need to share as chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. We're not going to go through all of these tshuva inside or the whole of each tshuva, but deal with this somewhat. The first question is to do with building security infrastructure on Shabbat. Second question is to do with conditional divorces for Jewish troops in World War II. And the third question is about the establishment of a national day of mourning for the victims of the Shoah. So these are all very much what I would call chief rabbonish shailas. Okay, they're not the shailas that come to the local shul rabbi.
So was it an official appointment?
Yeah.
Who chose, was there a Sephardi, who decided that it should be him, and was it university?
There was an election for chief rabbi on all occasions. I mean, it's always since Rav Cook's, Rav Cook was the first chief rabbi in modern times. It was a government appointment, so there's an electoral college that appoints the chief rabbi, and it's always been mired in political controversy, besides religious controversy. It's one of the questions who controls the Israeli chief rabbinate. Who does the Israeli chief rabbinate represent? There's sometimes there's been a tendency to have a Haredi chief rabbi in a government position which is not recognized by the Haredim, that's with whom the constituency that he's supposed to govern doesn't really identify with him, and all those sorts of questions and challenges. Anyhow, let's look at the first question here. Sheila, the question is Bimei Milchemet HaShichrur. So this is looking at the War of Independence, 1948-1949, Mishnat Tavshimchet. Bikshu lahakim geder bitachon misaviv lishkunat Kiryat Shmuel be'ir Tiberia. They wanted to put up a security fence around, just like it's revisiting how history repeats itself. A security fence round the Givat Shmuel area of Tiberia. Mechashash hit naplut haravim al shkunazu, because they're worried about an Arab attack against this this neighborhood. So can they put up this security fence on Shabbat as well? Can they just work round the clock to get the 7 days a week to get this security fence up? Now, as an aside, this is we'll look at his answer, but these are questions which are pertinent today as well, in terms of not just in Israel but establishing principled, security principles for us. We're clearly talking about, even without reading the response, but it's clearly not a case of imminent pikuach and certain pikuach nefesh, because there would be no question. In terms of if you've got Arabs, hurling, missiles at you, then it's clear that you can put up the wall. It's obviously this is sort of preventative pikuach nefesh for a threat which is uncertain but of concern, and you can almost translate those considerations even into the current security concerns that we've got here in this country at the moment. That's what security activities are we allowed to do on Shabbat, for an undefined threat which could be pikuach nefesh but might not be at all. That's so that's the question. So tshuva, I've taken out a few bits as well on the way But we're looking at the main issues. Kavod Torah Toldan. Sherak lahat triya al davar rachman al itzran. Mutar b'shabbat b'chol eretz Yisrael. Shikaf rachya achat. Now the Gemara in Masechet Tanit talks about where you've got calamity facing Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, in the place where the calamity is about to happen, then you're allowed to take the steps that you need to take on Shabbat. But elsewhere, we say all you're allowed to do is matrin. Matrin means to rally people. But you're not actually allowed to do any proper melacha. If there's devil, we're talking about the calamity is one of a plague. There's a plague. So if the plague, there's Ebola, right? In one town, right? So you can sort of make announcements and get people ready to start taking precautions elsewhere on Shabbat, but you can't actually immunize everybody on Shabbat because the threat is not mamish at hand. That's what the Rabbi Werner, who was the Av Beit Din of Tiberias, suggested in his question. Vani Omer, and Rav Herzog is responding, I think differently. Shezeh tali barofim hamumchim. You have to consult the best doctors that are around, the medical experts. Shem heim omrim shalul hipashet v'tarik l'chasein et ochlusia al yadeiz rikot. They say, no, there's a real worry that the plague can spread and that you need to inject the population. Afilim yesh behem melacha d'oraita, even if it's going to involve a melacha d'oraita. Im lo na'asem erev Shabbat, if it wasn't done on erev Shabbat, then mutar b'Shabbat, then you can do it on Shabbat. So we're seeing, he's establishing a model for us of preventative pikuach nefesh. And this is, really a klal in pikuach nefesh. You don't need to wait till the person is on their deathbed. You can do things, for pikuach nefesh to prevent a person getting to that stage of being on their deathbed, provided that it's a realistic chashash. That's, with everybody, sooner or later, each one of us is going to find ourselves on our deathbed. That doesn't mean to say that, I can be Mechalel Shabbat this week because, when I reach 120, I'm going to be an old ill man. So that's the first thing, observation that he makes, is that, if necessary, you can do Melacha D'oraita, which is preventative. Kvod Torah Adan. Now, if there's not yet any certain danger of there being an attack, and there's no pikuach nefesh involved today, even though it's true that in a couple of days' time there'll be a situation of pikuach nefesh, I saw it should be prohibited. This is what Rabbi Werner is suggesting. While came with Tiberia, so therefore in the case at hand in Tiberia, it's prohibited. Shamat Savlo Giadani Deka. The Arabs aren't attacking yet. It might be in next week the Arabs will be attacking. They're not attacking now. Why should we be able to put up the wall on Shabbat? Shelohaita od shum hitnap plut mitzat agoyim. That's, there's not yet been any attacks. The Chazal Amru, and Chazal say, this is also Gemara, Akum Shitzaru Ayarot Yisrael, that if Jewish cities have been besieged by enemies, Damashma Davka Im Tsaru Kvar, that means if you're already under siege, then you can do, then it's a situation of Pikuach Nefesh, and you can do what's necessary. So that's the suggestion that Rabbi Werner was making. And Rav Herzog is going to oppose that as well. He's going to say you don't need to be mamish under siege to be taking the necessary precautions. V'omnam keinhu, it's true shechazal hishtamshu b'lashon zeh. This is the expression that Chazal used. Aval nifsak b'shulchan aruch al piha o zarua. Shulchan aruch says she'afinim lo ba'ad kum adayin, ela rotzim lavo mechalin et ha-shabbat. Even if you haven't yet been attacked. But they want to come and attack you. There's an attack, is in the offing, right? So then you can be Mechalel Shabbat where necessary. Skipping to the next. So the first two things that he said is really it doesn't need to be currently a situation of Pikuach Nefesh. But it can even be a potential situation of pikuach nefesh that you can carry on taking the precautions. So then he goes on to say in the next paragraph, v'ulam k'tvot Torah Tordan. So you're suggesting, he's saying to the person asking the question, kanireh, mishum sha'adayin en yediyah she'rotzim lavo. We don't know for certain we're going to be attacked. P'usho'alim kein natil v'not choma b'shabbat b'chol ara Yisrael. Shema Yavo Goyim. Well, then, you know, we'll allow every Jewish settlement can build walls on Shabbat because maybe they'll get attacked. We don't know. They might get attacked. They might not get attacked. It could be Pikuach Nefesh. Let everywhere build a wall. Keep a Vardai, Hemrot, Simlit, Ma'apel, Alenu, Bechom, Makom. Really, certainly writing in 1948, 1949, every Jewish settlement was under potential attack. Klape Ze Ani Omer. There's, we can't know exactly what the enemy wants to do. They're not going to email us through first and tell us where they're going to attack. And this is, we just have to assess what's likely. It's a parallel case to a dangerously ill person. You've got to take expert advice and see what their assessment of the situation is. If your military intelligence is telling you there's likely to be attack, then that's... Then who could say that we should ignore that, he goes on to say, and we have to take precautions. So Rav Herzog here is coming out quite emphatically with the notion that the wall can be built if the security information is indicating that should be the case. But he says it will only be he says this in the next paragraph, we won't go through it all inside. It's got to be where your assessment is that this needs to be taken care of on Shabbat. If you delay it till after Shabbat, then it's not going to, it might be too late. Or one could say that if you stop working on Shabbat, then the wall might not be needed till Thursday. But if you don't finish building your wall till Friday because you didn't work on Shabbat, so then that would also be an issue of pikuach nefesh. He makes a number of qualifications, though. He says, number one, when you're assessing these matters, you need to have on your logistics, your military experts panel, you need to have some Shomrei Shabbat there. If you haven't got a Shomrei Shabbat, they'll all say that, no, of course it's an emergency, we have to do it. The decision has to be made by people who value Shabbat. It hasn't always been possible for me, but in my career as a rabbi in the shuls that I've been in, if I always try, it hasn't always worked, but I've tried as much as possible to have the security officer needs to be a Shomrei Shabbat. Didn't work in the shul where I had no Shomrei Shabbat at all. But my experience has always been that, security officers, that's, CSD has told us this is important, we've got to do it. And these things are important, but there needs to be somebody who appreciates if it's not really necessary for you to issue 18 people with walkie-talkies, right? You can get away with issuing two walkie-talkies, then that's a better situation. And that's going to be appreciated more by a person who's Shomrei Shabbat than a person who isn't. So you're saying, you can't let non-Shomrei Shabbat decide for us when it's necessary. But if Shomrei Shabbat are involved in this decision, they've got access to the facts, and reach the conclusion that it's necessary, then it's going to be necessary. So qualification number one is Shomrei Shabbat need to be making the decision, or at least part of the decision-making process. Number two is you can't have a situation where, every day they're working from, 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And that's why they need to work on Shabbat as well. No, work day and night throughout the week, and then you won't need to work on Shabbat. So it's only in a case where, you're working flat out during the week and you still can't get the security installations in place, by the time Shabbat starts, then you can carry on Shabbat. Or, Friday afternoon, information comes out about you know, potential attack, which is fairly imminent. Walls need to be up immediately, and they're going to work through the night and everything. But, you know, you can't say, well, we'll work, you know, Saturday so that everybody can go and play Sheshbesh in some, you know, cafe in Tel Aviv in the evenings. And the third qualification he makes is that nobody can be paid for this work. That's you're not allowed to be paid for work you do on Shabbat, so you can't be paid for that. In any event, yeah, I saw this as being a tshuva which is very illustrative, which illustrates very well that you know, Rav Herzog's responsibilities as Rav Harashi of this was Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael, that which, you know, wouldn't necessarily come to somebody else's door. He was, as it were, the communal Rav for, you know, the people that you know, he was ruling this for. Well, I don't think that was relevant probably in the you know, the 1948 War of Independence. That's you didn't trust the Arabs to build you a wall there. You know, it's you know, it was going to be sabotage, you know. That's you know, now there's protocols in place. I mean, you know, again, it depends who's in charge where in the army as to how, you know, Shabbat friendly it is. But, you know, in principle, a lot of the stuff is done by Bedouins. That's the principle. You know, whether or not it works in practice, I'm not sure that it always does. Tshuva number two was written in, I think, in 1939. I've taken out the first paragraph, which is, because it didn't fit on the page. I thought I got it all onto one page. That's, this is addressed to Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, who was a big supporter of Rav Herzog's candidacy for chief rabbi. So it sort of just, you know, shows even there, you know, how sort of the political forces, you know, yeah, Rav Chaim Moshe was in Vilna, you know, but he was, his backing probably got Rav Herzog the position in Eretz Yisrael. You know, but Rav Chaim Moshe understood the importance of having the right man in Eretz Yisrael at the time. That's, in any event, the first paragraph which I've taken out is a whole business about, it doesn't say what it's about exactly, but it's the Rav Herzog has been speaking to a cardinal, trying to have an arrangement made so they can have an audience with the Pope. That's, but it's a bit unclear. It's not sure if it's worthwhile slapping to Rome on the off chance that they'll be able to sort him an audience with the Pope. Or maybe it's not worth his wild slapping. That's, it doesn't say what he wanted the audience with the Pope about. Certainly, after the Shoah, Rav Herzog, he spent a lot of time going around Europe and trying to retrieve Jewish children who'd been taken into monasteries and convents. Had meetings with the Pope. Somebody was, I read recently, somebody who'd gone through his, who'd got access to his archives and all his letters from that that period of time. I can't remember now who it was even, but it was very fascinating. As they say, when he did go to the Vatican, the first thing he said when he came left Vatican City and came to Rome, he said, "Where's the nearest mikveh? Where's the nearest mikveh? Take me to the mikveh." That's, but it's famous stories that he, you know, he got access to go to the monasteries and to the convents, and he would go in, and these were children who'd been taken, you know, to save their lives, but also to save their souls, as it were, and turn them into good Catholics. He got permission to try and retrieve them, but some of them had been in, you know, the convents for 4, 5, 6 years. They didn't remember anything about Judaism. And what he used to do was he would go and he would sing Adon Olam or Shema Yisrael at a meal time and see who looked up, that's, you know, and seemed to recognise the words of Shema Yisrael. Then he'd know that these are Jewish Jewish children. That's in any event, this is pre World War II, where the World War II was on the horizon. That the storm clouds were gathering. Nobody, and even though there was anti-Jewish persecution in Nazi Germany, there was no inkling at the time that there was going to be a Holocaust of European Jewry. So he's not addressing the Shoah, he's addressing World War II. His question is about, can arrangements be made to create a get alternai, a conditional divorce that people going off to war will give to their wives before they go off to war? That if they, he's writing saying, looking back at the Great War, you had, people just, went missing, that's presumed dead, massive aguna problems, no halachic eidut to be able to be matir the wives. We're going to be, if we've got a repeat of what happened last time, we've got an enormous problem on our hands. Can we do something that a person could give a get alternai, meaning that a get that if he doesn't come back, then it'll be retroactively, it'll be a valid get.
This isn't just a modern question, though. This must have happened at the time of the Middle with the king.
It's not a modern question, except in its the breadth of its scope in terms of the they talk about even in the times of David HaMelech there was such a notion, but it's unclear exactly how it was how it was implemented. That's essentially from the time of the destruction, certainly from halfway through the time of the Second Temple, also certainly from the time of the Bar Kokhba defeat. Okay, you didn't really have many Jews in serving in armies till conscription in Tsarist armies in the sort of 18th, 19th century, but certainly widespread, tens or hundreds of thousands of Jews being called up to battle. This was a new phenomenon in terms of small numbers. It existed, but this on this enormous scale, it didn't. It didn't exist. So this is his question: what are we going to do about it? And he says that the Gaon. I'm looking at the second, third paragraph. Hakan Reb Malki El Zatzal Min Lumza Chatalim Tzor Takana B'Shat Behala. So he thinks Reb Malkiel of Lumza has got a solution, or he's proposed a solution. What's the solution? The most cogent of his suggestions is as follows. Kaniral Derzu. I don't know that much about Gittin, so there's one or two things which are hard to understand. Shekhiot Seha Bala Milchama. So when her husband goes out to war, you can't just write a get for your wife and give it to her and say, listen, darling, if I don't come back, this is your get. Okay? It's a bit more complex than that. So, yichtavu edim al piv harsha'a. So he should have witnesses write instructions on his behalf. Shetuchnahu, the contents being, shumamane kol echad me'aneim sa'im be'iro. He appoints anybody who lives in his city. He comes from London. I appoint any Jew in the city of London, lichtov get leishto, to write a get for his wife. V'chol shanim shnayim mehanim tzaim sham lachtom al get. And he says, I appoint any two kosher edim to sign as witnesses on that get. V'chol echad mehanim tzaim sham liyot shliach shelo, and that anybody from this city can be a shaliach and give the get to my wife. L'garesh et ishto beget zeh, to you to divorce his wife with this get. And he's also allowing the shaliach to make a tnai, a condition in the shlichut. So as soon as he leaves town, they should write the get and sign it. And then the shaliach gives the get to the woman on tnai. That if at the end of two years hence the husband has not been heard of, for a period of 2 years, right, Then titain haishala rav ploni pruta. The woman has to pay a penny or a pound, whatever, to the rav of the city. And he has to accept that. And then, when this condition is filled, then retroactively the get will work. And then they'll be divorced from this point in time. They need to be divorced from this point in time, because if they're not, you can't say we'll be divorced from a point in the future, because maybe he's dead at that point in the future, and you can't get divorced from a dead person. Maybe he's not dead, and you can have aguna questions, etc., etc., and all sorts of complications. So it needs to be a retroactive divorce from now. But he doesn't want to divorce her when he leaves, because he might come back. He doesn't want her to be married to somebody else in the meantime, etc. So, and there are various reasons why there needs to be a tanai, and why he can't make the tanai, somebody else needs to make the tanai, etc. That's the suggestion, that's the proposal. He says there's a problem with the proposal. He says, Reb Malkiel from Lumza, that he was dealing with a different type of reality. He was relating to the war between the Japanese and the Russians. What year?
1905.
Thank you. That's what battle? Crimean?
No, it's in the Atlantic.
Right, okay. What battle? The battle? What war?
It's Sino-Russian War.
Sino-Russian War. Right, where Trumpledore lost his arm. Right? Now, he says there, the soldiers went off to war, and they came back. If they came back, they came back at the end of the war. Right? He says, we've got a different problem. We've got a problem that you're sent off to the front, and you know what? Judging by what happened in World War One, you know, there's a chance after a year you'll come back, you know, for a couple of months, and then you'll be posted out again. You know, it didn't necessarily always happen like that, but you weren't necessarily being sent away to be away for 5 years. Some people were away for 3, 4, 5 years. That wasn't necessarily going to be the case. You had people who came back after a year, you know, for a couple of weeks, and then were posted, you know, posted again elsewhere. You could have, you had sort of, you know, you were posted to France, and your garrison fell or whatever. You came back, retreated back to England, then you got another posting. Yes, if you're lucky. That's so. Now he says, what are you going to do? Now he says, you come back, and you go home. Now, you've got a question. If you live together, you're intimate together with your wife again, what impact is that going to have on the get that's been written? Is it that this get is now invalidated? Or is it that it's a valid get, in which case you're having intercourse with a panuya, with a non-married woman? What if you're a Kohen? Okay, so you now divorced your wife, or she's divorced al tanai, perhaps. She might have the status of being divorced. If you don't come back within 2 years, if you're not heard of for a two-year period, then she ends up being divorced. Le mafrea, going back to the original date, and then this was a Cohen who was living with a divorced woman. So you've got all sorts of problems there. So he kind of makes, you know, various suggestions. It's a whole to and fro correspondence that went on between him, Reb Chaim Oster, and others, whatever. But this is the background to the question that he was addressing. The final tshuva that I wanted to look at is the question of the establishment of a national day of mourning for the victims of the Shoah. And this was a suggestion. This is Tuf Shin Hei. So this is in 1945, straight after the Shoah. The response, so this is pre-state, but the response of the survivors was that we want to be able to mourn all the people who've got no yahrzeit. Okay? They needed a day on which to say Kaddish. The conclusion was that Asara B'Tevet became Yom HaKadosh HaKlali, They never really took off. Maybe in the early days. So you know, nowadays, Holocaust Memorial Day in Israel is Yom HaShoah. That's Yom HaShoah. That's initially it was Asara B'Tevet. If you look in the Rosenfeld Slichot, you know, the special Slicha, you know, that said on Asara B'Tevet in memory of the victims of the Shoah. I don't think in Israel it's taken so seriously, you know, any longer as, you know, in that way. It might be that any survivors that are left, you know, who were originally saying Kaddish on that day, still say Kaddish on that day, but the national commemoration is on Kaf Zayin Nisan. And that's a whole story in its, you know, whole halakhic debate in its own right. In any event, Ule'inyan kviat tanit ledorot. So the question is, can we establish a tanit, you know, fix it in the Jewish calendar? You know, a new date in the Jewish calendar. Im yesh bazeh chashash shelo tosifu ledat haramban. Got a question about whether or not, he goes previously in the Tshuva, he's gone through the question of the mitzvah bal tosif, that you're not allowed to add to the mitzvot of the Torah. So he says, according to the Ramban's understanding, this could be a problem in terms of your introducing, there's 613 mitzvot, there are various, you know, festivals and fasts, and now all of a sudden you're coming along and adding one. Is that a problem of bal tosif? He says, Hinei im kein kasher gam al dalad somot. Well, that would be the same problem with Yeshivasa B'Tammuz. Yeshivasa B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av aren't in the Torah either. So if they could be introduced, then this could be introduced. Shema tomar ele neviim tiknum. So you might say, well, okay, the four fast days were introduced by the prophets, at least. Hagufa kasha. That's still the same problem. Halo ein navi rashai lechadesh davar me'ata. A prophet is not allowed to create new laws. So therefore, we have to have either, it's going to be one of two answers. Or shekevan shatidim lihibatel b'geulatan shel Yisrael, ein ze b'chlal lo tosifu. Now it might be, why do the four fast days not fall foul of the prohibition about bal tosif? It's because these aren't permanent fast days. The Tisha B'Av isn't a permanent fast day. Shavuot B'Tammuz isn't a permanent fast day. It's a temporary fast day until the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt. But nobody in mitzvot of the Torah, he says, mitzvot of the Torah are eternal. These aren't eternal, so it's not being established as a mitzvah. Skipping the brackets, v'im kein gam b'nidon didan kach. It's true with us as well. Sheik batel ha'tanik she'avon m'shech didkenu b'nei b'heirav yameinu amein. Nobody wants the day in memory of the Shoah to be for all eternity. When Mashiach comes, even the Shoah will pale into insignificance. We'll get over it. Or you could answer that the fast days, the four fast days, are actually just an extension of the detail of the mitzvah of tshuva. The mitzvah of tshuva is that when a calamity befalls the Jewish people, Jewish people have to do teshuva. One of the ways of doing teshuva is by fasting. So this also would fit into the rubrics. It's not a new mitzvah. Oh, there's a new mitzvah of Yom HaKadosh HaKlali. There's no mitzvah of Yom HaKadosh HaKlali. It's the old mitzvah of teshuva. And there's a new reason for doing teshuva. So he doesn't seem to think it's going to be a problem with Bal Tosif. He says also we can bring a proof from the fact that he says there's a Maaseh Rav. He says this is Jewish reality. Kaf Sivan Shegazru Vad Arbar Tzot L'Tanot Bo. There is, or there was, it's fallen into disuse now, but certainly in pre-Shoah days, there were communities in Eastern Europe, in Poland, that kept the 20th of Sivan as a fast day for the Gezerot Tach V'Tat, Chelmnitsky massacres, right? And the 20th of Sivan was observed as a fast day. So if the 20th of Sivan can be observed as a fast day, this can also be observed as a fast day. So he says, oh, maybe it's different. You could argue that the 20th of Sivan, that wasn't binding on all of Jewry. That was just binding on those areas of Poland, and that's why it's not a problem. But he answers that as well. He thinks it was originally for everybody. Then he goes on to say that in any event, we've got a principle. It comes in Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchot Megillah, in Chai Adam, in Hilchot Purim, that if you've got there's a mitzvah. It says in Shulchan Aruch, if a town is saved from catastrophe or something, it can establish its own Purim. That's and there were traditionally various communities or families that had their own celebration of Purim on various days. It wasn't Purim, you know, it was their own Purim, as it were, the day on which they'd been saved. So if you can have a festival to celebrate salvation, you can have a fast day to commemorate tragedy. So his conclusion is that it's going to be permitted. We'll just look at the very poignant comments at the very end of the tshuva, where he says, "Va'olam heiruni echad negdi v'zeu." It has been suggested to me that I'm wrong, he says. "Adain lo nigmara milchama." Who's to say the war's over? "Umi yodea." Who knows? "Efshar shemasha avar aleinu hu chevle mashiach." Perhaps this was just the birth pangs of Mashiach, and there's worse still to come. We need to wait till we've got a full conclusion. Tav Zayin Tevet, Tav Shin Hay. Yes, this would have been winter 1944. This would have been written. Okay, so the tragedy and the terrors of the Shoah were known. The war wasn't over yet. And he didn't want to... Chevle Mashiach, I don't know if he means that... No, he must mean, I've said it wrong. Because maybe the sun's about to shine on us. That's maybe this is Chevle Mashiach. Don't want... Let's wait till the war is over before we establish a Yom HaKadosh HaKli. Clearly, maybe salvation is just round the corner. He says this is really worth thinking about. So in 44, he didn't want to establish a Yom HaKadosh HaKlali yet. He thought in principle it was right. He just thought, you know, let's wait. You know, I suppose December 44, people knew the war was drawing to an end. Right, so you know, there was a sense that it was, it was drawing to a close. Let's wait and see whether it will be appropriate then to have a fast day, or maybe this is Chevle Mashiach. But again, you know, very, you know, interesting teshuva, which I would say all of these three tshuvot go way beyond the regular sort of rabbinic remit that we've seen, you know, to date, of the questions that the rabbis were dealing with, and we're looking, you know, at a new era of responsa, which is dealing with issues that affect the nation as a whole. And see, it wasn't, you know, I mean, some of them were the smaller issues as well, but you know, here is constituency was the whole of Eretz Israel, or the whole. It wasn't, you know, it was these are public policy issues, etc., etc. Find it very, very fascinating indeed. Next week we'll be crossing the cultural divide to Rav Benzion Mechai Uziel, who was the first Rishon Lezion or Sfardi chief rabbi of Medinat Yisrael. He wasn't the first Rishon Lezion. The position of Rishon Lezion is far older than the position of chief rabbi of Israel. There was a Sfardi chief rabbi going back well before the time of Rav Kook. Rav Uziel was chief rabbi at the time of Hakatam Atam Medina, coming from a Sfardi perspective, but again addressing a number of issues, very important issues to do with the creation of a Jewish state, and I think it should be fascinating next week as well. Adkan.